All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like... Oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back to Taxation is Theft, the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off and cheating you out of your hard-earned money. Broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker deep within the jungles of Mexico, I'm Dan Taxation is Theft Berman, former candidate for President of the United States, currently in the race for Governor of Texas. And today, I have a couple really amazing guests. I'm very excited about this episode. You're going to want to stay and listen to all of it. It's going to be some really amazing information here. Joe Bannister is a former special agent of the IRS. Many years ago, he learned the truth about the income tax and now stands by the statement that there is no law saying that the average American has to pay income tax. Shocking. This is going to be amazing. And of course, we have Dr. Joe Goodwin. He's an attorney with more than 20 years experience fighting the IRS in the courtroom. And he's joining us with a nom de guerre to protect his clients and his career because, you know, the courts don't like it when you talk bad about them. I don't know how I've gotten away with saying so many things about the IRS for so long. But Dr. Joe Goodwin is going to give us some really good information about how to fight the IRS in legal terms. It's not legal advice. Don't try this at home. John McAfee is going to be the subject of what we're talking about tonight. He's a software entrepreneur who founded the McAfee antivirus that everybody knows so well because it's practically infecting their computers. He's openly stated for the past several years that he doesn't file or pay income tax, which has led to an indictment by the IRS for tax evasion. And we've been seeing a lot of his tweets over the last couple of weeks. He has been avoiding the U.S. like the plague through Cuba, South America, and everywhere else. And he was recently arrested in Spain, and they were considering extraditing him to the U.S. for his tax evasion crimes, but they decided not to, and just a couple days ago, he was released from prison. And what's really amazing about this story is he was on Twitter tweeting the whole time he was in prison, and everybody was like, how did you get on Twitter from the prison? He's John McAfee. So before we get started, I want to ask you, if you're watching the live streams, make sure you like and share and comment and ask your questions while you're watching. Start a watch party, share this with your friends, because this is going to be some really, really awesome information. And of course, head on over to taxationistheft.info. Anything you do at that website, whether you're buying a hat or a flag or a t-shirt, or even just following our social media or following our podcast, it really helps to support the show and make sure that we can continue to bring you all this really, really amazing information. And now, on to the show. First, let me just say, Joe and Joe, it's an awesome pleasure to have you both on the show. So thank you so much for coming here. And I usually start out each show by asking, which tax do you hate the most?
As far as the taxation is theft, I mean, in a sense, it is taking property from someone else and then, you know, using it for some other purpose other than what the person who earned it, whatever purpose they have for it. I guess I haven't quite worked out in my mind that there may be some need for some amount of taxation, but I can also recognize that, especially in this country, after so long, we can see where some or a little bit always turns into a lot and guns to the head. So I'm very see eye to eye with the taxation is theft, admirers. But the income tax is certainly, in my opinion, the most odious and most dangerous, because it does reach out and touch each and every American. Either whether, like you said about John McAfee, admitting very publicly that he doesn't cooperate with what the IRS wants him to do, to the people that are just under the radar and that's how they live their lives, to the people who don't really know how to fight back, and so they're just intimidated into compliance. So to me, the income tax is certainly the most odious and you know, as I often say, it is the income tax is the darling of Karl Marx, not Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. So that should give everyone a good idea about, you know, what the income tax is really all about and why, if a tax needed to be hated, that's the one to pick.
Well, I can honestly say I do hate the income tax, but I have to qualify that a little bit in that the income tax laws, as they were originally written, and as actually they still are written, although through about 100 years of the erosion and accretion, the government has pretty well bastardized even what they originally said. But I say that only because from their inception, from the inception of the income tax, as Joe pointed out, it is the second plank of the Communist Manifesto, but the proponents of the 16th Amendment and the Revenue Act of 1916, it was their intent. It's obvious from studying the history and then the writing and amendments to the to Title 26 that the intent from the beginning was to bastardize it into a tax on labor, which is not what the law actually says. It isn't what the 16th Amendment said, and it wasn't what the court said from 1916 with the first interpretation of the tax law in the Bush-Haber and Stan v. Baltic Mining cases, all the way up to basically FDR's time and the era of the Glenshaw-Glass case. In all of those cases, the Supreme Court and the appellate courts were clear that the 16th Amendment conferred no new power of taxation and that it identified in excise that the government already had plenary power to invoke. So I think the Stanton case most succinctly sums it up when it says that it merely relegated to the area of an excise that which the government already had plenary power to levy. And so that's why I hate it, because the intent from the beginning was to make slaves of the entire American population. And if you think about it, this is a little known, you know, sequence of events, but, you know, essentially we had, you know, English settlers, and much of the South was settled by aristocrats growing cotton and tobacco, and they loved their slaves. By saying I love their slaves, what I mean is they loved to own them. Not all slave owners were abusive per se, except for the fact that slavery itself is abusive. But not all of them were, you know, whipping and beating and being cruel and inhumane to their slaves. I mean, I treat my dogs well, but that doesn't mean I don't own them. But what happened was, you know, no sooner was slavery abolished and the slaves set free, then those same powers set about to enslave the entire country. It's like, well, if we can't have our slaves, then we'll just make slaves out of all of them. And that's exactly what the income tax was created to do. Further, of course, it was created to pay the interest on a fiat money supply that from the moment it was conceived of the Federal Reserve System, they intended to shake loose from any constraint by a gold standard or anything like that. So that's why I hate it, a very short question.
No, I absolutely agree with that. And it's I've actually come to see the property tax as more of an enslavement than the income tax recently. But we could talk about that later.
Since you bring it up, and so many people get into trouble over that, I'd just like to point out what they teach you in law school about property tax, and it does make some sense. The reason property taxes were justified was because in old England, you had these noblemen with huge estates, vast fiefs that had been granted by the king. And they would then pass those down in trust to their heirs. And oftentimes that land would sit idle Meanwhile, the townspeople and the quote-unquote peasants, the common people, were starving to death. And so the property tax was conceived of as a way to prevent that from happening. The idea being that if you couldn't use the land to make enough money to pay a de minimis tax to your county, you bear in mind these are county taxes, then probably you shouldn't have and control that land. And the idea behind property taxes, at least in the United States of America, is to encourage the productive use of land so that land wouldn't sit idle, so idle that they can't even make enough money to pay the property tax. So that's the justification for it. Now, perhaps the counties have gotten out of hand and we might need to address that, but that was the theory. And I can't say that it's necessarily an evil motive.
Right. But of course, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. So
precisely,
we've seen a lot of government try to do good and end up in the wrong direction. But before we get too far off in that tangent, because believe me, I can go in a million tangents when it comes to taxes. Let's talk about John McAfee. So I actually have his indictment up here, and I want to start out by saying this. When I talk to a lot of people, and Mr. Bannister is more of an expert than I am, certainly on the income tax, and I think you are too, Mr. Goodwin. But when I tell people there's no law that says most Americans have to pay the income tax, there's so many things that their mind just jumps to, and I know this has to do with the media and the way that we're conditioned. But they jump to, oh, well, then show me where that law is that says I don't have to pay. Or show me the court case where somebody won. And the one that they always go to as the gotcha is Wesley Snipes. Oh, well, there's no law that says you have to pay income tax. Why don't you tell that to Wesley Snipes?
Wesley Snipes did win.
Right. Well, he did. And Joe Bannister and I had this. This is so confusing when you're both named Joe. Mr.
Why don't you call me Joe A, and we won't say what that's abbreviation for. And he can be Joe B because his last name is Bannister.
So Joe B I'm sure he's told me this more than once, and I even forget it because that's how well the media has conditioned us. But you just said it. Wesley Snipes beat all of his charges except for what? One small misdemeanor case, right?
It was several misdemeanors for willful failure to file, but the evasion and et cetera, et cetera. He beat all the felony counts.
Right. So, but that's not the story we heard, right? The story we heard on the media is constantly, oh yeah, see, you can't escape the IRS, and he tried, and now he spent all this time in jail, he spent all this money in fines and all this other stuff. And that's the story we hear. And whether or not, whatever the true story is, the reality is that when I try to tell people the truth, the first thing they jump to is, well, that's not true, and this is why. And then they bring up this case. So what's an absolute fact is that these people are afraid. They're afraid of the IRS, and they're afraid of whatever information you could possibly give them to the contrary. So what's interesting about McAfee's case is I don't think he's in the same position that Wesley Snipes was. And I'm reading through the indictment, and I'm like, this is such a simple indictment. And from what I know, and I'm still not an expert. I know I've been looking into this stuff for maybe a decade, and I know there are plenty of other people who have been into this since all the way back in the 1970s. And so I wanted to get your guys' opinion on this indictment and see is this an empty threat? Are they hoping that he doesn't know what he's talking about and he's going to take a plea deal and just pay it? Is there real force of law behind this? Are the courts corrupt and just going to, stick him in prison no matter what? What's actually this indictment made of? So I'm going to bring this up on screen for anyone watching the video, and I'm going to read a few of the important points for anybody who's listening to the podcast. So first it starts out by saying this is the Western District of Tennessee. This is United States of America, the plaintiff. The United States of America is the injured party who is suing John David McAfee. And they cite right at the top Title 26, which is the income tax, Sections 7201 and 7203. And I'll bring those up in a second. And so it's a really short indictment. It just says John McAfee is a resident of Tennessee. He's earned millions of dollars in income from various sources, including but not limited to. That's actually interesting. We'll get into that in a minute. It says including but not limited to, whereas they use the word including without but not limited to in the laws. We'll talk about the word including in a minute. But so they mentioned a few things where he made all this money. It says the Internal Revenue Service was an agency of the United States Department of Treasury responsible for enforcing and administering the tax laws of the United States. Now, I'm sure this is just a typo, and I'm sure there's some conspiracy theorists that are out there that are going to say something about this, but I was thrown off by the Internal Revenue Service was an agency of the United States Department of Treasury. And that's because I know there's some patriot mythology that says the IRS is not part of the government. I'm not too sure on that. But anyway, so this goes on and on and on, and then they have count one, which is for 2014, count two is 2015, and they have a different count for each year. But it's very simple. All it says is violation of 7201 and 7203. And I'm going to bring these up, and I'm going to spare you all the time. I'm just going to read the first sentence of it. It basically says, any person who willfully attempts in any manner to evade or defeat any tax imposed by this title, blah, 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 shall, pay some fines and go to prison. That's Section 7201. And Section 7203 is willful failure to file a return. And it basically says the same thing. Any person required under this title to pay any estimated tax or tax, that's interesting, or required by this title to, blah, 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 file a return, penalties and fines and jail. So these are the two charges that are being filed against him. Now, what's really, really important on this, and this was kind of the center of the discussion for tonight, is if you look at the word person, and this is an awesome site right here. This is Cornell Law University's website, and they make it really easy to find out when words have a special definition. And this actually hops over to Section 7343, where it defines a person, where it says, a person, as used in this chapter, includes an officer of an employee of a corporation, an officer or employee of a corporation, or a member or employee of a partnership, who, as such officer, employee, or member, is under a duty to perform the act in respect with which the violation occurs. So there's a little bit of a dispute here because it says the word includes. And a lot of people will say, oh, well, it just says it includes that. That doesn't mean something else. But in the indictment, we saw they use the words including but not limited to, which is a little bit different. But, of course, this is why we have Mr. Goodwin on to kind of shine some light on this and tell us a little bit about, is this really only to do with corporations or does this affect every American?
Well, obviously it affects every American because people go to jail all the time for this stuff, but I have to just kind of back you up a little bit in that I have this conversation with new clients all the time, and that is you can read the law, you can read the cases, and you can see what they say, and if they're too complicated for an ordinary person to understand them, that means essentially that the law is void for vagueness and wouldn't apply. So if they say, oh, well, you got to be an attorney to understand this stuff, that right there should invalidate it if we had a judiciary that had any integrity whatsoever. However, there's a practical reality. And so I caution my clients that I can counsel them about the law and they could understand it, but that isn't necessarily going to end up with a good result in court. And the reason for that is that our courts are, especially our federal courts, are really hopelessly corrupt. In fact, the corruption of our federal courts cannot be understated, as is evident by what we recently saw with the Supreme Court, stating that, Texas voters can be disenfranchised when another state violates the Constitution. And they say, oh, well, they had no standing because they can't tell the other state how to do their election laws. Well, that statement was true, except for the part that they have no standing. But the complaint wasn't about telling the other state how to do their election, how to perform their elections. It was about the disenfranchisement of the Texas voters because of the illegal acts of the Pennsylvania officials. So what I'm trying to get at here is that when it comes to the practice of law and when it comes to, you know, winning or losing in court and so forth, you really have to look at the practical realities and you have to deal with those if you want to have an outcome that might be helpful. I often describe my job as damage control because, like I say, the courts are just plain corrupt. These judges will, you know, they're prejudiced. Most of them are, think about a federal judge. I mean, these are plums handed out to people that will toe the line. Most of them, you know, couldn't make it in their own practice if they tried. You know, they graduated maybe from a prestigious law school, and so they got a job at some big firm, you know, and then they become a federal judge. They have their political agenda. Many of them are perverts, and they're being blackmailed. But for whatever the reason, the law be damned. If the law supports their prejudice, whatever the reasons for that prejudice, well, then the law is good as gold, and you'll see lots of opining that follows the law. But if the law doesn't support the result that they want to get, they simply say, well, you know, appeal dismissed or lower court decision affirmed, or they just refuse to address it. Or in the case of the Ninth Circus, we have them actually lying about what the Supreme Court says. You can go into a case from way back called In re Becraft, where Mr. Becraft, who many people have heard about, filed an actually a very, very erudite brief with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they sanctioned him $2,500 and basically said that the Brochaber decision says the exact opposite of what it says. Now, this is in the record, and you can go back to the Brochaber decision and then read the Baltic decision, which sums it up, and see that they're simply lying. And so this goes on all the time in federal courts. So, you know, it's very difficult for me to talk on about the law and give all of your listeners the impression that the law is going to, you know, that standing on the law is going to get them a good result in court. None of us would be here. We wouldn't be having this conversation at all if the courts had any interest in following the law. On the contrary, we can go back all the way back to FDR's court backing plan and see that the courts have been packed according to the communist plan. And they've been packing them for 50 years now. And we can see that at every turn when it comes to tax law, the courts have subverted the very notion of fundamental rights. I mean, I could give you 17 cases about how the right to work and earn a living is fundamental. And yet we have this situation here where the courts hold that the Internal Revenue Service has the authority to impose a tax on your labor. Totally, totally fallacious. Yet that's what the courts do. So it's very difficult for me to negotiate that and to get clients to understand that we don't have the best, we may have the best legal system in the world, but it's populated by the best judges money can buy.
Wow. So, I mean, that's now I can see why you've joined us with Anam Daguerre. That's, you know, some really strong words there. And at the same time, it's also a little, that's a little scary. So, because
it's more than a little scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is there any hope? Because, you know, I hear people all the time who say, well, I just don't want to have to pay the tax. And you're telling me I don't have to, how do I do it? And I don't really have an answer for them because, you know, I know the IRS still wants to come after people. I didn't say that.
You misinterpreted what I was saying. What I was saying is that you can look at the law and think that you're going to stand on it and lose. But I didn't say there's no way to avoid getting sucked into this rape of the common man, which is exactly what it is, by the courts. There are ways around it, but it's very counterintuitive. And you have to go with practical realities.
Right. And I've seen this. I'm actually reading a book right now, as a matter of fact. Where did I put it? I think it's called Winning Your Case. And that's one of the things that they talk about is, you know, especially when you're dealing with juries, arguing the facts of the law is not always the winning case. There's a lot of emotional appeal that goes into it, which is, you know, not the way a legal system should be based. But, you know, like you said, that's kind of the practical reality of the world that we live in.
Well, that's so true. I mean, and, you know, a lot of really good attorneys, some of them fairly noteworthy and brilliant, have gone in and they're just spot on the law, but they lose a trial court because they don't understand that the prosecutors, especially in federal tax cases, they win their cases by emotion. They go in, they rip their shirt, they cry heresy. You know, you have, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you have to pay your fair share. Who the hell does this defendant think they are, not paying their fair share? And bear in mind, the federal courts will not allow the jury to hear the law. In fact, judges work very, very hard to make sure that the law does not come before the jury, because if they saw it, they would probably acquit. So they tell the jury, oh, you're only here to to judge the facts. You know, and if this defendant did these things, then he is guilty. I'll tell you what the law is. Now, that's not traditional American jurisprudence. At the founding of the Republic, the founders were very clear. The juries are to determine the law and the facts. But the federal courts and state courts, too, have gone out of their way to strip the jurors of that knowledge. And there's an organization called the Fully Informed Jury Association that's worked very hard to rekindle that. But so when it comes to juries, it's very important to all you trial attorneys listening out there that you work the emotions of the jury. Anytime a prosecutor brings in testimony or facts that suggest that your client was some sort of evil person because he, you know, had several bank accounts or several businesses or whatever, and use that, you know, as a lead in to suggest that that's nefarious and they're trying to evade the tax. You have to cross-examine your witness and make it very, very clear to the jury that there was a sound economic and business purpose for those decisions, and bring out the fact how this client contributes to charities and helps old ladies across the street and so forth. Because jurors never hear the law, they rule almost exclusively on emotion. And federal prosecutors know that and they capitalize on it. Biggest mistake defense attorneys make.
Well, and this is interesting too, because I remember when I first started getting interested in this, I was a big follower of Erwin Schiff. And I remember reading about when they were trying to ban his book, I think it was The Federal Mafia. And what was interesting about that case was the judge ruled that the book couldn't be banned because he was telling people not to file and not telling people to do something. So basically the argument was he was telling people not to do something rather than telling them to do something, which was illegal. And that's why they arguably said we can't ban the book. Contrary to like the idea that you would think, if this book is so terrible and it's so full of lies, why couldn't they just point to something in that book that was a lie and say, see right here, this book is lying, and therefore he shouldn't be able to distribute this information? I thought that was really interesting.
Well, you're spot on with that analysis, which reaffirms what I just said.
Yeah. So but there is a way out. Is there a way to avoid the system altogether? Is it really just, you know, the luck of the draw that they actually go after someone? I've heard of a lot of people who do not necessarily zero returns, but they dispute the information on the W-2 or the 1099 and say, you know, they dispute that with the IRS. They get everything square with the IRS, so it never goes to trial. Do those people get audited? Is there any way, like, is there maybe like a golden pill that will keep someone from having to pay this tax and at the same time keep them out of the legal scopes of the IRS or the Department of Justice?
Well, as Joe B could tell you, all you have to do is click your heels together three times and say there's no place like home.
And that's what I did. Look how I turned up.
No, all seriousness aside, there are ways to do it, but it varies from person to person. But what I would do is give people some hints. First of all, you need to look at 6011, excuse me, which is the return filing requirement. Now, 6011 says that you have to file a return or statement. So I've known people that have been very successful by filing statements in lieu of return, wherein they point out at the opening of it that they've requested that the secretary tell them what tax that they may owe and what form they're required to file. And the secretary, having refused or failed to do that, they are filing a statement. Now, that statement would have to then comply with what we call the Beard requirements, wherein the Supreme Court laid out what the contents of a statement in lieu of a return, in lieu of a form prescribed by the secretary, which is how the term return is used in that section, what that statement would need to contain in order to be considered satisfactory of the 6011 obligation. Now, that doesn't mean you are required to file a return. So what they do in that situation is they say, well, I don't think I am, but just in case, here's all the data that you might need if the secretary wants to go ahead and file what's called a substitution for return. Now, even the tax court itself has said that substitutions for return, which the IRS supposedly prepares when they do an assessment, must be signed under penalty of perjury. Yet at the same time, we have the tax court continuing on to ignore so-called assessments where there's been no attestation under penalty of perjury by, you know, any officer of the IRS, any kind of agent. So there's lots of, this is where I say, you know, the practical realities have to be taken into consideration. When you're dealing with somebody who's a quote-unquote W-2 employee, from what I've observed through, you know, lots of experiments by people such as, you know, Pete Hendrickson and his followers, and oh gosh, it's just so many others. There's Dave Champion out there. And both of those gentlemen have written really excellent books. Their books are very, very thorough, and quite honestly, they're very factual. They're not necessarily an error, but that doesn't mean that people that follow their advice don't get into trouble. But what I found with people that work for an employer, you have to look at the W-4 form. What is the title of a W-4 form? It is a withholding allowance certificate. Now, why would they need you to sign that if the government has the authority to withhold from your pay without your signature? You know, that should be a clue right there. Now, this form was first introduced during World War II when the Victory Tax Act was passed, and it allowed people that had Social Security numbers. And basically, that Victory Tax Act was a big push to get people to sign up for Social Security, because most Americans really didn't see the need for it and weren't buying into it, much like a lot of people aren't buying into the COVID hoax. But So we were in a world war, and Americans tend to be very patriotic, which I think is a good thing. And so they passed the Victory Tax Act, and then Walt Disney came out with the Donald Duck cartoon that said, hey, you know, get your Social Security number, and then you can, you know, file this form with your employer that gives them permission to withhold from your wages, and that will go to support the war effort. So you had people in droves going down and applying for Social Security numbers for the first time, and then filling out W-4s. Now, since then, the courts have held that that's a mandatory form, which of course is ludicrous. I mean, it's false on its face. Yet, you know, judges say this kind of stuff with a straight face all the time. And hey, they can order the federal marshals around. So basically, it's gun barrel justice. This has nothing to do with the law. But be that as may, you need to look at the Code of Federal Regulations, Section 301.6109, subsection G. And in there, it says that when you have a Social Security number, the IRS is going to presume that that makes you a resident for tax purposes. when they're talking about resident, they're talking about a resident of DC in the 50 enclaves. Now, I mean, we could spend hours really going over how they've muddied the waters with definitions and so forth. But anyway, but it says that if you file the proper form as prescribed by the secretary, they will no longer make that presumption. So again, there's ways to deal with it that, first of all, by filing a statement in lieu of a return, if it's properly done, then you start the statute of limitations running for both assessment, which is 3 years, and for fraud, which is 6 years. And the nice thing about it is the secretary is never going to come back and tell you what tax you owe or what form you are required to file, because to do so would be to lie, first of all. And second of all, then all you'd have to do is go look at that statute or that law and those, and perhaps those forms, and you could pretty readily see that they're, you know, lying to you. So they don't want to get off into those weeds. What they do instead is they, you know, try to label things frivolous, but if you meet the beard criteria, they can't do that. So they tend to just ignore these and let the statute run. But there's other techniques as well. And the thing about like going into them is, like I say, each person in their situation tends to be somewhat unique. And so if I say, just click your heels together 3 times, say there's no place like home, you're probably going to end up being, you know, run over by that light at the end of the tunnel, which turns out to be a freight train instead of the end of the tunnel.
Right. So, so I guess, you know, I'm still looking for something that I can tell people when they ask these questions. Is there somewhere they can go or someone they can talk to? I know Paymon's got the Freedom Law School out there, where he helps to educate people to do this on their own. I know, you know, it sounds like you know how to do this pretty well, but you obviously don't have the capacity, or you'd be pretty expensive if you did, to handle, you know, let's just say 150 million Americans who are paying taxes right now who shouldn't.
We're getting close to that. I want to say that I am working on that, and we've had a couple breakthroughs here recently that look very promising, and I would be happy to share them if I had tested them on enough guinea pigs. But I'm very reluctant to say, well, I think something should work, to say it will work.
Right. Well, hey, I'm always up for a good experiment.
Well, and you know, I appreciate that, and maybe I'll take you up on that offer.
Awesome. Yeah, because there's, and you know, I've talked to a couple people you know, there was another gentleman out there who I've had on the show a couple times, and he's kind of had that same thing. He has kind of a program that starts out with a little bit of education. But I'm still a little bit skeptical, kind of because of all the things that you just said, where no matter how well prepared you are, there's always the chance that, you know, you're going to be taken to court, they're going to look the other way, they're going to say the law doesn't matter, and you're going to go to jail. And so it's a very scary prospect, I think, for anybody. But you know, I'm always looking to people who are doing this, because I know there are some people who have, you know, quote unquote, gotten away with it, but sometimes they stay silent thinking, maybe I just got lucky, maybe I shouldn't tell anyone, because if I do, they're going to come back around and investigate me and find out that one little mistake I made. And, you know, as much as I, you know, respect their desire to stay silent in that way, I think it's, you know, it doesn't really help our cause of shining light on the fact that, you know, we're all paying all this extra money. And of course we can get into all the reasons, you know, we're paying for wars that we don't support. You know, we're paying for all these like disastrous monstrosities that the government calls justice. You know, we're paying for all these things we don't like. And that's that, you know, in a free country of all places, that shouldn't be the way things are run. And so we have to try to get out of that mindset. And, you know, even to Joe's position, like, yeah, I'm not supporting some form of taxes, but I'm saying some part of, you know, the government, if the government wants to exist, it needs to have some sort of revenue. And I would prefer some sort of, you know, a voluntary system. And yeah, maybe it's not the perfect system. Maybe we can't figure, but like, I think this one right here is the biggest, just abomination of legal justice in a free country. And so I think, you know, everybody who knows anything about this should be as vocal and should be, you know, trying the experiments at, you know, whatever risk. And some of them are willing to risk it all. Like John McAfee is, he's going way overboard with his risk. You know, he risked his ability ever to come back to the United States and not go to prison. And you know, some people are willing to risk more, but like when you do make the risk and you do have success, I think it's absolutely important that we share this information with everybody. And I use this analogy all the time too, that, you know, when some people say, you know, yeah, well, you know, you can't get away with it. Wesley Snipes went to prison. Al Capone was arrested for, you know, tax evasion. They have all these wonderful examples. And what I like to say is like, yeah, but the first few rockets that they shot into space blew up and killed everybody. And now we're sending people into space all the time. And the laws of physics never changed. We just understood them better. So we learned how to defy gravity and get, you know, millions of tons of mass into orbit. And now we've got satellites, we've got, you know, people landing on the moon, people going to Mars soon, all this amazing stuff just because we continued to learn. And I think the same is absolutely true with the IRS. And as, you know, people like yourself, Joe B, Joe G, you know,
she's fine.
Researching all of this and learning all this information, I think gives us that much more power, you know, to show this truth to everybody. And ultimately, I think that's what it is. If everybody understands that, you know, what the federal government is doing is wrong, that's ultimately going to be a turning point where, you know, they can't just look the other way anymore.
Well, I'd like to, I don't mean to steal the show, but I've just got to say a couple things. One is, Al Capone was convicted for stamp tax violations on liquor sales. Okay. There may have been a couple income tax things, but it was primarily his bootlegging. But secondly, the government does not need taxes for money. There is a perfectly legitimate way to fund government at levels greater than it needs. And the key is in the First Continental. A lot of people are familiar with the phrase, not worth a continental. Well, that's referring to the Second Continental. But the First Continental was a tremendous success. It was a fiat currency. And it was Benjamin Franklin's big mouth to Lord Rothschild when he was our ambassador to England. When Rothschild asked him, so to what do you attribute the success of the colonies? And Franklin said, well, that's simple. It's our continental. It facilitates commerce and we've blossomed. And with that information, the very next thing Rothschild did was introduce the coinage and stamp tax that was eventually the cause of the first revolution. But my point is this, if we simply nationalize the Federal Reserve and then make it so that the these new federal treasury notes could only be loaned by the federal government to the states, and then the states could only loan those to the counties, and then at the county level, they could either have county banks or franchise commercial banks or combinations of the two municipal banks, but let the counties decide how they're going to take those funds that are borrowed and lend them into the community. What we would have then, and then we strip the government of all powers of taxation. Now what would happen is the only money the government would receive would be the interest on the money supply, and the federal government couldn't hoard it all. The states and the counties and the municipalities would share in those revenues on the interest on the tax supply, on the money supply. So let's say it's a 3% markup at each level. So the federal government loans to the state at 3%, state loans to the counties at 6%, counties loan to the municipalities at 9%, and say the money goes into circulation at 12%, but we have zero taxation. We eliminate this huge burden that all businesses are paying in accounting for and answering to. We eliminate a huge burden in enforcement in the IRS. The government's actually going to get more money than they're getting now in real money. I'm not talking about inflated money. But because, you know, the numbers work perfectly if you go back to like 2009, but now when you add the several trillions of stimulus now, it kind of screws things up. But the point is there's plenty of money there to run government. And what it does is it puts government in the position of having to encourage a healthy economy such that commercial borrowing makes sense, okay? Because that's the only way the money's going to get into circulation. And then what we do is we say all debts to the government must be paid with these notes. However, the states are still required to circulate coinage according to gold and silver coinage according to federal standards. So we have gold and silver coin circulating, but not pegged to the federal notes, simply circulating alongside the federal notes. But in order to pay money back, it has to be paid with the notes, which guarantees the interest payments to the government. What this does is businesses are going to flourish. I mean, there's no taxation. And people pay interest on loans all the time anyway. And there's all kinds of books, Robert Kiyosaki, and we could go back. Some of the authors escape me offhand, but I mean, you know, using other people's money to fund business is a very smart idea. And what happens, of course, then is our economy would go gangbusters. Companies would dump the countries they're in and flock to the United States in order to take advantage of that, because borrowing money at 12 or even 15% with no taxation and no burden is a great deal. It's a wonderful deal. And the freedom is, you know, worth, that's really what we really want. Now, let's say we can't quite get there. I would say eliminate the tax on individuals entirely and tax the crap out of corporations. Who cares if the products go up in price? Corporations are fictitious entities. This notion by the Supreme Court that corporations are persons in every sense of the word and therefore they can give to political campaigns is, again, a ridiculous political contrivance. It makes no sense at all. Corporations are fictitious entities. They can't be convicted of a crime. They can't be put in jail. And they have all kinds of benefits. They can issue stock to raise capital. They have all kinds of advantages over natural persons. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with taxing a corporation. But taxing an individual on his labor is slavery. We're just talking, if the government can take 1% of your labor, they can take 100%. So we're just talking percentages of slavery once you get into that realm. So there's all kinds of things we can do. So when people say the government needs taxes for money, I say BS, not true. And the First Continental proves it. But we could do it again, and we could do it better than the founders did. But there's lots of mistakes the founders made, and nobody's talking about those mistakes. We could correct them, and they would solve a lot of problems.
Right. Yeah.
And end of tirade.
Yeah, no, that's a lot of really great information. And, you know, I know listeners of my show know that I'm very much against the Federal Reserve. But at the same time, you know, I'm not entirely against fiat currency. And my real issue with fiat currency is that it's mandatory at this point. They've basically outlawed everything that competes with it. They've tried to outlaw gold in so many different ways. They've outlawed Bitcoin in so many different ways. Just in, you know, people say, oh, Bitcoin's not illegal. Well, not really, but the license requirements to be able to, you know, to create an exchange that changes dollars for Bitcoin. All these things that they put in place, they haven't outlawed it because they can't, but they have put up as many legal barriers as they possibly can. And, you know, it sounds like what you're talking about is a system where the fiat would exist, but it would be in fair competition with other currencies that, you know, anyone could just use what they want.
Well, that's true. That's true, except for to pay debts, to pay back your loans. But I want to point out something that's often overlooked about fiat currencies. Fiat currencies are only negative when they can be inflated. And so right now we have this Federal Reserve system where you have this trickle-down thing. The Federal Reserve issues the currency to the banks. The banks get first use of it. And then they can multiply that times 10 because the reserve ratio is a 10% reserve ratio. And so you have this trickle-down thing so that by the time it gets to the people, it's almost worthless. But also they can force inject those funds into the economy. with the system that I'm talking about, the only way new funds come into the economy is where there's a genuine commercial demand. And so, therefore, the currency could not expand faster than the economy. And when that happens, there is no inflation. I mean, think about it. Let's say we have a completely gold currency. It's all gold. Okay, and let's say I go to the bank and I borrow $100 to, go import some wine from Europe and sell it here. So the bank is going to charge me interest, right?
Right.
They're not going to loan me the money for free. Nobody would do that. So if there's only X number of ounces of gold in circulation at the time, in order for everybody to pay back the gold they owe, there has to be more gold either dug out of the ground, or the gold increases in value and will buy more goods. But the point I'm making is that any time you have commercial borrowing, you are expanding the economy. And if the money supply doesn't expand accordingly, then the price of goods goes up. The currency becomes more valuable. So expanding the money supply at the same rate as the economy keeps prices stable. But, the price goes down. I'm sorry, I was up, down. You get the idea. The point is that people borrow money for commercial purposes, and when those goods or services come into the economy, that makes us all wealthier. And so if the currency doesn't keep up with it, it doesn't matter whether it's a fiat currency or gold or silver. If the currency doesn't expand in supply equal to the new goods and services coming in, then you either have inflation or deflation. It makes no difference whether it's fiat or not. So the problem with fiat currencies is when they can be inflated disproportionately to the expansion of the economy and thereby benefit disproportionately those who have first use of those funds.
Right.
Very, very important.
The printing machine. And I've said this about Bitcoin too, because people think Bitcoin is not inflationary. When it actually is, in fact, they're mining new coins, and arguably at some point they're not going to be able to mine any new coins. But then, just like you said, it becomes inflationary or deflationary based on the demand or its perceived value. So it absolutely will still fluctuate. Once that happens.
I have serious problems with cryptos in general, though, only because I personally had an experience whereby I was locked out of my crypto account.
Same
and way. I've never been able to get back in.
And of course, once, if the power grid goes down or the network goes down, even temporarily, you don't have access to any of that.
Correct.
So there's people say it's the amazing end all of all currencies, but no, the reality is, don't put all your eggs in one basket, right? You might have gold, you might have some fiat, you might have some Bitcoin. Expect anything.
And what's wrong with cows and fish? I mean, anything that can be traded can be a currency. And so I agree with you. You don't have to be locked into one.
Absolutely. Joe B, you're quiet over there. You want to give us any, I know we're going a little bit over on the show. You want to give us any closing thoughts? We kind of went off topic from the taxes, but what's your opinion on some of this stuff? Because we usually don't hear you talk about stuff other than taxes.
I think it's great to go off into the Federal Reserve and the monetary system, because the income tax and the monetary system are joined at the hip. They're married. They both came into being in 1913, and that wasn't a coincidence. So
right.
I think it's always good to remind people to become more aware of the monetary system, the Federal Reserve, while they're educating themselves on the income tax. So I think that's a great jag that you went on. The only other thing I'd point out, when you were talking about Erwin Schiff and the banning of the book, or the attempt to ban his book, and then you were also talking about the people being open and spreading the word and talking about these things openly, should point out that one of the weapons that the federal government has is this injunction process, where they will seek an injunction to basically muzzle a person for talking about the income tax. There's a gentleman named John Kottmeyer, who was the founder of Save a Patriot Fellowship, or Irwin Schiff, many others who've faced this injunction gauntlet and got to a point where there was a court order prohibiting them from speaking about certain topics. And so for people that think that we have free speech, you know, they might look into these injunctions against very brave patriots like John Kottmeyer of Save a Patriot Fellowship or Irwin Schiff, and how this shouldn't be happening in a free country. Dan, as you correctly pointed out, if there's something false about something that someone is saying or writing, then point out the falsehood and people will disperse. They won't want to listen to that person. But just like the COVID stuff or the lockdowns, it's always about censorship and hiding the ball from the public. And, you know, inquiring minds realize that that's because they don't have the truth on their side. So anyway, I just thought you brought up a lot of great points, and I was silent because you were making those great points. I'm just pointing out how, you know, why they're great points and how people can check in a little bit more about these attacks on the First Amendment rights for people who want to talk about, you know, taxation topics or Federal Reserve topics, as well as the, you know, these censorship efforts. So,
right. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a great point too, because the First Amendment was not, who said this? Judge Napolitano. The First Amendment was not written so we could talk about the weather. And, you know, these are, I feel like he quoted Thomas Jefferson or something with that one. But I think that's so important, because a lot of people, it's the same, like, you know, burying their heads in the sand, where so many people will say, what do you mean? We have free speech. We can say whatever we want. And it's like, yeah, but you've never really said anything that profound that, you know, has really pissed off the federal government, because if you did, you would know you really don't have freedom of speech as freely as you think you do. I think that's, you know, it's kind of an eye opener. And, you know, for me and for so many people that I've met, you know, we all think the government is a great system. It's there to protect us, until we just happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, and the government kicks us in the teeth when we were doing what we believed was the right thing, or, you know, doing nothing at all.
I would just like to say one thing on both of your points. If you look at both of what you both just said, it comes back squarely to the judiciary and a corrupt judiciary. The idea that courts are ordering people to not to be able to speak on certain subjects. Look at what happened with California Prop 8. Three times the people of California defined a term, marriage. They defined a word. They didn't say you couldn't be queer, you couldn't be, you know, these other, LGBTQ. They didn't say that. They just said marriage means, it's just a definition. Three times the courts said no. And so what we have here is we have each time the court is enabling the corruption of the other two branches of government. The other two branches could not get away with that stuff were it not for the courts, and people need to wake up to that fact.
Absolutely. And Joe B., I wanted to get your opinion on, you know, if somebody asks, you know, how do I not pay income tax, what do you say to them?
That it depends. A lot depends. I mean, I think it's good for people to educate themselves on ways, but I guess to put it in a nutshell, it depends, because it depends on how much you earn, for example, how famous you are. Wesley Snipes, for example, I've checked both of those boxes, right? The IRS loves to go after famous people, because then there's lots of publicity, and the more publicity, the more fear that can be generated in the public. And then the more you earn, or the more that the IRS can claim that you earned as part of your evasion scheme or whatever, that can uptick your sentence, because your sentences are based on, at least in the tax arena, are based on the so-called tax loss. So if you're a wealthy movie star who makes, you know, tens of millions of dollars per film, and the IRS takes a slice out of, you know, 2 or 3 years of your life, well, there's going to be a huge amount of dollars involved in that controversy, and your sentence is going to be massive. Whereas if you're an actor who isn't known that well, you'd make a decent living, but not that much, chances are the IRS is, you're not even going to come up on the IRS radar screen. A small business person versus somebody that works for a W-2 wage. Let's say they both make the same amount of money. Well, the W-2 wage earner is a lot more captive, right? Because the employer, the business where they work, is going to decide whether or not they take money out of their paycheck. And they're going to decide if the IRS comes and says, we want to levy that paycheck and make you take it out, whether the company complies with that IRS demand. So I know, you know, as does Dr. Goodwin, we know all kinds of people that are wage earners that do not file an income tax return. They stop withholding on their paychecks, and some experience zero problem, and some experience major problems. And a lot of it depends on, you know, their fame or lack thereof, how much money they earn, whether they have assets that are publicly known. You know, they have a name on their house, they're partners and, you know, various partnerships. And there's, so a lot of it depends on how well known it is about the property that they own. So that's why I say it depends, not to weasel out of answering, but just to say, we know all kinds of people that aren't filing tax returns and aren't paying income tax. But it really varies. It's not a cookie cutter approach. And one thing that no one I know can eliminate is the risk that, you know, you still might get in the crosshairs of the IRS and you could get hammered. Now, again, Wesley Snipes, he had the money to pay for a Cadillac or Mercedes defense, and he was acquitted of all of the felony counts that carried the longest prison sentence. He went through a lot, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, doing whatever it was, a year or two in a federal prison camp, and, you know, maybe missing out on one movie, you know, I mean, probably in the grand scheme of things, it really wasn't that horrible of a result. Probably more a wound to his ego. And, you know, I can't speak for him, but I'm just trying to put it into perspective. I was indicted on 4 felony counts as the IRS tried to besmirch my reputation, and I was acquitted of all those accounts. But it still cost, you know, $240,000 to defend myself. And fortunately, I put out the word, and American patriots from all over the world came to my defense. So my legal bills were paid. I had to basically take off about 7 months of work. And my investment was preparing for 7 months for my trial. And like a test that you over-prepare for, if you pass the test, who cares that you over-prepared? So
right.
I was deservedly acquitted of those charges. But, you know, it's tough. Sherry Jackson, another former IRS agent, she was attacked, prosecuted, and all kinds of dirty tricks that the prosecutors pulled, she was convicted. And yet, in my opinion, and the opinion of anyone that followed her case, she deserved acquittal just as much as I did. But the dirty tricks of the Department of Justice and the IRS, you know, they've had many, many decades to, you know, sharpen the arrows in their quiver, their dirty tricks quiver, and figure out a way to take people down, even if they're completely innocent.
Right. So I want to thank you guys so much for joining me today. I want to give you one more opportunity. If there's anything you're working on, if people want to learn more about you, if there's a book you want to promote, anything like that, I'm going to start with Dr. Goodwin. And I'm sorry, I just realized when Joe said Dr. Goodwin that I've been calling you Mr. Goodwin this whole time, and I should have been saying Dr. Goodwin.
Well, you know, the doctor... The doctor thing is kind of funny, you know. Tucker Carlson recently just destroyed Joe Biden for her doctorate because it was her dissertation was, you know, like maybe first grade level. But the doctor is, because when you get out of law school, you get what they call a JD, a Juris Doctorate. So technically, you know, I'm a doctor, but I'm not like a medical doctor. Be that as it may, you know, I would like to recommend, Jeff Dickstein's book, Judicial Tyranny. I think Pete Hendrickson's book, Cracking the Code, is a good book. And I also think Dave Champion's book, Income Tax, Shattering the Myths. Yes. I think those are all good books. I would simply caution people, read them, get educated. They're actually superb books for educating yourself. But contact Joe before you're going to take any action, and he might be able to hook you up with counsel who, for pretty reasonable price, might help you negotiate the shark infested waters. And also, I am working on a book, and we're working very hard on a one size fits all solution, but it's been elusive. They've worked very, very hard to cover their tracks. So that's all I have to say. Thank you for having me on, by the way. It's really been a pleasure. It's been fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, I know the one size fits all thing is kind of like, can I just have can I install something on my computer that's going to keep me from getting hacked? And it's like, no, it's a cat and mouse game. The rules are always changing. The opposition is always coming up with new ways to, you know, in this case, get your money or to send you to prison. And, you know, the rules are constantly changing. So
the fact that they're doing that, have been doing it for almost, you know, 80 years now, is the most frightening aspect of it. I mean, our government is working very hard in a very criminal capacity against the people, and has been for a very long time.
Absolutely. And Joe B., anything you'd like to point us in the direction of? Where can we? I know you've got agentfortruth.com.
Sure. Thank you. Yeah, I guess I don't know if my screen shows up there. Agentfortruth.com is the website. And I do have a book published, I guess, a little under 2 years ago. And if you go to agentfortruth.com, you'll see where you can make a donation and then get a book sent to you. I think it's a good book, and I think
I second that.
People might want to check it out.
Absolutely.
Not and to I mention, haven't... maybe one more thing. At agentfortruth.com, there's a section called What's This All About? And I'm kind of proud of that section, because I think free of charge, it lays out the basics of why the income tax is a scam, you know, based on my research and, spitballing with others in the tax movement. So I think it's a great place with links for people to, educate themselves at kind of a one-stop shop. And not, again, like Dr. Joe said, no need to take any action except to just educate yourself and put your foot in the pool, you know, before you jump in, or put your toe in the pool, shall we say.
Awesome. And I don't know how I missed this new book of yours, so I'm actually going to head over there right now and get my own copy. And Dr. Goodwin, I'm also really interested in what you're working on, so I'm definitely going to follow up with you. But I want to thank you guys again so much for joining me and for sticking with me. We went a little bit over. But this has really been amazing. I hope the audience got some really, really great information out of this. And if you liked what you heard, I want you to remember to go ahead and share this video if you're on Facebook or YouTube. Share this podcast with your friends. Invite others to get here. If you're listening to the podcast, make sure you subscribe. Of course, go to the website, send us your comments. Tell us how much you love this show. Tell us we're doing a good job. And of course, head over to taxationistheft.info and support us with buy one of these really awesome hats that make really great Christmas gifts. And they're a really great way to spread the word that taxation is theft. Thank you.
Yeah, I've I'd like to say one last thing. I would put it in your chat thing, but I'm afraid we're going to get cut off before I can pull it up. Everybody needs to look at the definition of trade or business in the code in 7701. Okay, because they always say, are you engaged in a trade or business? And people think that means, you know, running a hair salon.
Yeah, I guess.
It does not. Yeah, so look at that, because they define words that make you think it means one thing when, in fact, the legal definition is completely different. So
right.
Just a heads up.
I want to pull this up because this is a really good one. The term trade or business includes the performance of the functions of a public office. Although, this is the word includes again. You want to give us 10 seconds why the word includes does not mean everything?
Well, if you look in the dictionary, the word to include or includes is a word of separation or distinction. Even if they use the term includes but is not limited to, includes is a term of confinement. So it's includes means whatever it says it means, and that's it. Now, even if it says but not limited to, what that would mean then is it has to have some relationship to what the definition is. In other words, it would have to have some relationship to the performance of a public office. You see what I'm saying? So if they're saying, well, that means it includes this and other things. Well, those other things must have some relation to what the definition said. It can't just be everything, or no word would have any meaning whenever it says this includes such and such.
Absolutely.
But sadly, isn't it the case, this is a non-attorney speaking, but isn't it the case that even though Dr. Goodwin is pointing to, black letter law in terms of the way a statutory construction and the way that it should be interpreted, you have plenty of appeals court judges that say, oh, you're a cosmetologist? That's a trade or business because I said so.
Absolutely. They're just shameless. The federal judiciary... the corruption of the federal judiciary cannot be understated. And I mean that with the most sincerity.
Amazing. Awesome, guys. Thank you again so much. Thank you for listening. And I'll see you guys next time on Taxation is Theft.
God bless you all.